Isolation at home and social distancing everywhere else, are they making you feel anxious? If so, you are not alone. Later on in this podcast, we'll talk about the mental health consequences of a global emergency that none of us now living has ever experienced before. In the meantime, we'll look at what's being called an unanticipated silver lining. With all the debate about Obamacare and universal coverage and Medicare for all, it's been all too clear that America's healthcare system as currently structured is not sustainable. Now comes the coronavirus pandemic, revealing, quote, some of the worst elements of America's broken health system. That's from a New York Times op-ed piece by Dr. Amol Nawathe and Ezekiel Emanuel, directors of the University of Pennsylvania's Healthcare Transformation Institute. Dr. Nawathe joins us. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get to transformation, what are the worst elements of the broken system that are now being revealed?
So the broken system, I think from an infrastructure perspective, is probably the main thing that we've revealed in the COVID pandemic. So I think there's two things that I would highlight. So one is our ability to quickly shift capacity to areas of healthcare that we really need. That's one area that we've realized that we probably weren't as ready as we thought we were. And that's purely from an emergency preparedness perspective. The second aspect that I would highlight is not related to COVID per se, but I think the change in practice patterns that we've experienced as part of COVID has revealed that our system has been stuck in a legacy way of doing things when actually we very much had the capacity from a human perspective, from the ability of physicians and nurses and other healthcare workers to change how they do things, from to a technology perspective, the ability to, for example, to provide telehealth care from the comfort of your own home to the comfort of your own home. I think we've realized that we had this potential. The system just was broken, so broken that it didn't support really pragmatic patient-centered changes.
So you say these are practice patterns that aren't up to speed, essentially. Does it also involve revenue?
It certainly does involve revenue. So I think, you know, if we take oftentimes now we talk about telehealth as kind of the chief example of how the system previously wasn't functioning, and now suddenly we've been snapped into a world where we're providing perhaps a lion's share of healthcare through telehealth. And reimbursement, revenue certainly have a important role to play here, because previously they weren't either they weren't reimbursed at all, or they were reimbursed at a much lower level than other types of healthcare services. And so if you were a very rational healthcare leader, either in a hospital system or a physician practice, it was more revenue generating to bring somebody into the office to have a clinic visit than it was simply to do a telephone visit or a video visit. And learning psychologically and economically from the perspective of investing in technology to do this something a different way just wasn't supported by the financial model.
So you say then that the financial model encourages, or has been encouraging, doctors and hospitals, I take it as well, not to behave in the most efficient possible way.
I think that's correct. So, you know, if we look over the last couple of decades, we have seen amazing advances in healthcare technology, and I mean that in the most general sense. We are more capable now than we ever have been to take care of fairly sick individuals who have specialized needs outside of the four walls of the hospital. And yet that transformation has been very slow to happen. We have seen it in certain pilots or certain demonstration projects in pockets. Innovation does happen, but it's happened in pockets. And in some of those pockets, it's been wildly successful. But it hasn't happened universally. It hasn't touched all of Americans, or hasn't touched even all of Medicare beneficiaries, for example, in a way that I think would be beneficial for Americans and Medicare beneficiaries.
Given the limitations of digital technology and the internet, is this more of a problem in rural areas than it is in urban settings?
Well, it certainly presents an amazing opportunity in rural settings. And, you know, there are examples. So let's make sure we're clear and honest about what has happened. So there are some pretty remarkable projects. One, for example, called Project Echo, that was done in New Mexico on Native American reservations and other rural areas to really advance access to specialized care or specialty care in rural areas. So again, there are pockets of innovation that have occurred, but you're absolutely right that in the rural areas, the ability to catalyze, you know, access to different types of care in a remote fashion would be totally game-changing. And while it, again, has happened in certain places, hasn't happened uniformly across all the rural areas.
So telemedicine then may be an example, if we treat it properly now, of what you refer to as an unanticipated silver lining of coronavirus. And I think you probably want me to make clear, and I certainly do as well, that we're not talking about a silver lining as if it's okay to have coronavirus and we wanted to have it in order to get this, but rather that there can be opportunities, as you suggest, as a result. So telemedicine might be one of them. What others are there?
That's a great question. I think, you know, we have seen hospitals change the way they've practiced in general. So, for example, a lot of lower value healthcare services that are provided, you know, sometimes elective surgeries that maybe weren't so beneficial for the patient. We've seen hospitals dramatically shift away from doing those, and as well as physicians and surgeons. We've seen psychologically a change in the way of practice towards more patient-centered, cost-efficient care. So we only do things now when we really have to do them. And I think these are really fundamentally important shifts. I mean, I think probably the single point that I would argue here that I think is most important is, you know, 10 years ago or so, we had the Affordable Care Act passed, and we actually had within Medicare a new center called the Medicare Innovation Center that was started. And the sole purpose of that center was to catalyze new payment and delivery models to try to affect change, to try to make care for Medicare beneficiaries better. And I think as an extension, other Americans as well, as those changes spilled over to everybody else. And what we found here is the delivery system, the healthcare system of America, doesn't necessarily have to change in these really tiny, minute kind of ways, shift to shift to shift. It's actually capable of shifting in a very dramatic way when needed, and in a way that could be much more cost efficient. And I would argue in a way that could actually save American healthcare. I mean, we know, pick your leading economic indicator. We know that healthcare is not sustainable from an economic cost perspective in this country. You know, the Medicare trust fund's expected to go bankrupt in just a few years, 2026, if you look at some of the estimates. That's a right around the corner. The way that the health system has shifted in the past 3 months shows us that we're capable of the type of change that we need to save American healthcare.
So let's talk about those dramatic shifts that you're talking about. They have to do with something that everybody knows, but nobody wants to admit. Hospitals conduct surgeries when they don't need to. Doctors provide medications that aren't necessary. They have people come into their offices when they could talk to them on the phone. So there's a huge amount of waste.
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, the National Academy of Medicine, for example, estimated that there's over $1 trillion of healthcare waste. So there's a lot of waste out there. And, you know, I'm an economist. I'm also a physician. But I happen to think that the way our system works financially has a major role to play in that. And this is important to remember that, you know, we're not necessarily pointing fingers here and saying that people are unethical or pernicious or trying to harm people, but rather that the pattern of care that is rewarded is one that if you're on the fence about whether this is really good for a patient or not, and you believe that there's some world in which this is good for a patient, you're going to do that procedure, whether you're a physician or a hospital. And if we were to change the paradigm to one where what we're really thinking about is, so what is the best way to achieve the outcome that we really care about, then the entire orientation would change. And hypothetically, the cost efficiency of the system would go up. I will say that I don't think this is totally academic or hypothetical. I mean, when we do look at systems that do operate under different financing models, probably the most famous and well-recognized right now in the country is the Kaiser system. You know, Kaiser Permanente is able to provide quite a bit more cost efficiency and good outcomes for patients. And it does that because the entire system functions in a fundamentally different way than the way that most of American healthcare functions.
Okay, so let's get back to that silver lining with coronavirus. Hospitals are being cleared out now, so those patients can be treated. Doctors' offices are being shut down, and we're still able to function, but revenue has been drastically reduced. So does that mean there's a need for federal subsidies?
So, you know, I think we do need to focus on the short term. And in the short term, what we're asking of hospitals and physician practices and healthcare workers is in essence totally new. And, you know, we have seen in a very encouraging way, you know, we like to say healthcare workers are our heroes here. I think they, you know, individuals and systems have adapted rapidly. You know, they've taken operating rooms that are meant for surgery and they've converted them into ICU type rooms to take care of sick COVID patients. And that comes at a cost. So, you know, I would say we have to be clear-eyed that in the short run, our goal should be to support hospitals and physician practices and the system to continue to provide high quality care in the context of COVID, and to retain the ability to take care of patients who are not suffering from COVID, but who have significant burden of chronic conditions, you know, whether it's cancer or heart disease or something else. We want to make sure that the system doesn't change so much that they can't get any care that they need. So, you know, my sense is immediate term, we do really need to worry about the sustainability of the system and the short term ability for the system to respond.
Well, you recommend three policies by the government and by the Congress. And the first has to do with whether the practices involved stay independent. And if they do, you say, then subsidies are, in fact, appropriate.
Yeah, I think one thing to recognize here is, you know, there are multiple entities and stakeholders who don't have the deep cash reserves of larger systems. You know, in essence, they can't really live through troubled waters and survive. And if they don't survive, what does that mean for us?
So these are doctors and groups of doctors and various others who don't have the kind of support you have when you have a big hospital.
Correct. And to that matter, even, you know, small hospitals in rural areas would count in this as well. You know, just they just don't have the deep cash reserves. And for these hospitals and for these physician groups and other organizations, it's critically important for us as a society to keep them alive. And there's two reasons for that. You know, one is just access. So, you know, we want to be able to have rural patients, for example, go to the hospital if they have an emergency or if they get hurt. And if that critical access hospital in a rural area shuts down because it can't stay solvent, then, you know, it's Americans who are going to suffer. The longer run view is even in urban or suburban areas, we do have smaller physician practices and groups that because of the rapid reduction of care that we've suddenly seen in the context of COVID, their cash flow has been hurt and their ability to sustain this is also not deep. And so it's quite possible that they will become bankrupt and go out of business. And if they do, what that means is they will perhaps be gobbled up by a larger system or an insurance company. And if they're gobbled up by a larger system, that means greater market consolidation and probably higher healthcare prices and perhaps lower access. And that's not good for the long run of the American patient or the American healthcare consumer.
So the money for it then should come from Medicare?
So the Medicare, the money could come from Medicare, but it doesn't necessarily have to come from Medicare. I mean, the taxpayer themselves, you know, from Congress could support this from a sustainability perspective. You know, I feel broadly that health insurers in general have a role to play here. So Medicare is an important health insurer. And in that sense, if Medicare could do advance payments, for example, or reimburse. And we've seen some rules that have just come out actually late last week that did allude to changes or actually indicate changes in how telehealth services are being reimbursed to try to help practices recover some of their revenue to keep them alive and keep them healthy as much as we can do. So I think To your point, I think Medicare certainly has a role to play here, but this doesn't need to be restricted from our perspective to Medicare alone.
Well, then you say that virtual visits, telemedicine, as you talked about earlier, should be reimbursed at the same rate as office visit. Why isn't that being done now?
So the thinking behind the traditional system that we've had, and mind you that this is the same fee-for-service system that we've had since the 1970s and 1980s, is one where physical visits and physical activities that a clinician does are rewarded the most. So in fact, the system rewards, for example, if I do a biopsy on somebody's rash more than if I think really hard about how to diagnose it. So procedural activities are rewarded more than cognitive or diagnostic type activities. And in that same vein, seeing a patient in the flesh is rewarded more financially than doing a telephone visit. In fact, until very recently, there was no way to be financially compensated for the time of doing a telephone or virtual visit. And so that's the legacy system from which we have grown. And it's a good, you ask a good question. So why is it the way it is? I don't think we have a great rationale for why the system is the way it is or was the way it was. I think what we are seeing in the context of COVID is that the system is changing. As I mentioned, recent regulation changes from Medicare to actually reimburse televisits just the same as we called for in the New York Times op-ed. And I think that's progress because that allows clinicians to focus on delivering care to patients in the way that one is most clinically indicated. So what's best for the patient from a clinical perspective for their health? And secondly, what is best for the patient from the patient's preference perspective? I mean, one thing we've learned during this rapid shift to virtual, if you will, is that a lot of patients really appreciate being able to get care in the comfort of their own home. You know, many are quite capable of taking their blood sugar or weighing themselves at home or taking their blood pressure at home and reporting that to the physician in a virtual fashion, whether it's over a telephone or a video visit, and then getting instructions about how they need to change their medications or do something different. And I think that's the type of flexibility that American patients and consumers really appreciate. And as a system, we need to think about how we can support that flexibility, both on the side of the physicians and the clinicians, as well as on the side of the patients and the consumers.
If I may, though, it seems to me there's a downside to that, or potentially one, at least, until you persuade people of the kind of point that you're making. I have had people say to me, I had a problem of one kind or another, and all the guy did was call me up on FaceTime or whatever it was. And, he spent 20 minutes with me and he charged me $500, you know. How could that possibly be worth it?
Yes. Yeah. So you're absolutely right. I mean, let's be clear. There's no perfect system. There's no perfect payment system. There's no, there's no perfect way to do this. And I think every system that we create or every change we make has to come with some accountability attached to it or some monitoring attached to it. And I think that's really important. So, for example, in the op-ed, as we discussed, if we were to make these payments around sustainability to try to keep practices independent, we would expect that they remain independent. If they don't remain independent, then those should now no longer be subsidies. Those should be loans that need to be repaid. So we need to have requirements. Similarly, if we start to pay for healthcare in a different way, if we start to say, we're going to compensate a televisit much the same as a physical visit, we need to ensure that patients aren't harmed because of that. All of a sudden, it's easier for a practice to do a televisit and maybe they stop doing as many in-person visits when really the right thing to do is do the in-person visit. So we need to attach to that accountability for the quality and for satisfaction of patients. If patients aren't happy, in fact, I think, we've had people argue to us that there's going to be a generational view on this. There are going to be some older patients who it doesn't sit well with them to do all televisits. And maybe they do need to go in and be examined by a physician and see them in the flesh. And if that's their preference, they should most certainly have access to do that. And I think, protecting the patients and protecting the consumer from unintended effects is also an important aspect of what we need to call for.
You also talk about changing from the fee-for-service program or system to a fee for patient system. And I'm interested in that. Does that sort of go back to this myth of the barefoot doctors in China who get paid as long as the patient is healthy, and then they don't get paid when the patient is sick?
So I think, you know, it has some similarities, if you will, to that. I think the general sense here is that if we pay physicians or really pay anybody to do an activity, they're going to do more and more of that activity. And to some extent, that's good because that means that they're doing stuff and they're productive. On the other hand, that does also mean that we are giving them the incentive to do that activity, whether it is really producing health, better health or not. And that's why we found ourselves in the system of large amounts of waste and potentially what we call in the healthcare world, low value care, you know, basically healthcare services that aren't really generating health benefits for patients. The idea of moving to a fee for patient system is that in certain settings, particularly in primary care, it is not a very transactional way in which people achieve health. You know, it is not simply I go to my doctor, that doctor tells me to do something, I do that, and then voila, I'm healthy. You know, rather, it's investing in a way of life. It's lifestyle changing. It's exercising more and taking the medications I'm told to take and following up with the specialist and getting my cancer screening, whether it's a colonoscopy or a mammogram or what have you. And because it's holistic, it's comprehensive, the idea that we're going to reduce something that is as important as comprehensive care down to a set of transactions, I think just doesn't make common sense. It doesn't make sense for how we want to achieve population health, for example, health of our American population. And so if we can shift to a system which does understand and recognize that there's complexity and a comprehensive nature here beyond transactions, then we're more likely to achieve those goals. Now, I do agree with you or agree with anybody really who says that, well, that system has problems too. And so we do need to think carefully about creating the right accountabilities to ensure that that system also functions as intended and doesn't create other harms.
So medicine is more than a business. It's one of the things that you're saying, it seems to me, and I think we can all agree with that. And one of the silver linings that you talk about might be this, that people who are now being treated for the COVID-19 are going through a lot of trauma, and there's a lot more attention being paid to the mental consequences of disease and the fear of disease. And you talk about regularly screening patients for mental health conditions and how that would be a very important thing to be able to do. And yet, isn't that more difficult if you're teleconferencing than if you're in person?
Yeah, it is a challenge. I mean, I think one of the broad challenges that we face as a society here is we know that physical health improves with socialization. In fact, you know, one of the most amazing things is in elderly populations, social activity is not only linked with living longer, it's also linked with having less heart attacks and less dementia, for example, less Alzheimer's. So socialization is an intrinsic part of human existence. And here, as part of the public health response to save lives, we're being asked to step away from something that's very ingrained in who we are as humans. That's a challenge, absolutely a challenge. And to say that we can take great care of people who are lonely and as a consequence depressed in a remote fashion is certainly oversimplifying. That being said, you know, we do have virtual health platforms now, and the ability to check in with patients in a remote fashion is something that we do have capability for. And so to the extent that we can get on a virtual visit, if you will, and touch base with an older person who we know, for example, might live alone on a weekly basis to say, how are you doing? Are you feeling lonely? And are you feeling depressed? It can actually be quite simple. There's validated ways for us to do this in the clinical world of two questions or less, and get a sense of how they're doing and make sure that if they are not doing well, that we could try to find ways to assist them with counseling and support and anything else that we can do. So I do think it feels paradoxical that, you know, maybe wait a second here, can we really address loneliness through a remote fashion? But I think, in fact, at least screening for it is something that we can do quite effectively at scale through virtual means.
Let's just go quickly through the last three recommendations that you make for the Congress. And the first of them is this. You say elective procedures are so profitable now because the government overpays for them. And what we have to do is reassess payment for the top 100 elective procedures. Basically, what would that do?
So that comes back to the point of, you know, if we compensate people for doing something, they're going to be doing more of it. And the reason we pick on elective procedures is because anything that's emergent or urgent, largely we don't want to touch, right? We want people to be able to have great access to high quality care right away if it's urgent or time sensitive. But when it's elective, that suggests that there is some discretion. There's discretion, particularly on the side of the clinicians and the hospitals who are recommending this. And so what we're suggesting here is that if we can right size the payments to more linked or in line with what the health benefits are of those procedures, and less linked to how technically complicated or how resource intensive they necessarily are, which is to date how reimbursement has been set, then we're more likely to get the quote right number of procedures where patients are benefiting more than they're being harmed by those procedures. And that's what we're trying to get at here is how do we right size the payments so we're driving the right incentives and patients who need the procedures are getting the procedures because they're producing the right health outcomes, and patients who might be getting unneeded procedures wouldn't actually get those procedures in the future world.
Okay. And you also say that low risk patients, and I assume that means people that aren't being transported in an ambulance because they have an emergency, be offered care at home options, and that procedures or services be paid for the same, whether they are performed in the doctor's office or in the hospital or at home or someplace else.
That's right. I think, quite frankly, this is us being very pragmatic. You know, at the end of the day, we should be trying to deliver care to patients in the way that best suits them, and generally patients prefer to be home. Now, as I mentioned earlier, you know, in the past decade, we've seen pretty remarkable technological advances that let us take care of patients in the home in the same way that we used to decades ago in the hospital. And in fact, you know, one example of these programs is something that has a moniker associated with it called Hospital at Home. And so if we can deliver care to patients in the home that they wouldn't otherwise get in the hospital and do it safely, you know, to your point, these are patients who are, not on the verge of having some catastrophic event or have an urgent condition. These are patients who need some steady care over the course of a few days, and they need perhaps a nurse or a physician to visit once or twice a day to take some labs, check their vitals, give them a medication or an IV or something like that. Then that's something that we could do. It's cheaper because it doesn't require all of the rigmarole and infrastructure of a hospital. Doesn't require a big hospital building with a hospital bed and all of the expensive equipment that goes there. In fact, we can deliver this in the home. And really, it's about the cost of the physicians and nurses and the supplies to do that. And that turns out to be more efficient. We're certainly not the first to have thought of this or suggested it. It's actually, in some sense, an old idea, if you will. The VA system, the Veterans Affairs system, where I'm a practicing physician, actually does this. They have a hospital at home program. They call it a telehealth program. And when patients get admitted with a congestive heart failure exacerbation, meaning that their lungs fill up with fluid, not in a dramatic fashion, but slowly, we can send them home and a nurse will go and administer a medication to help get that fluid out. They actually pee it out. And we can do that safely with the right type of monitoring. So what we're hoping to do is create give a pragmatic solution to stimulate and support that type of innovation so we can deliver more cost-efficient care to patients, more than likely, where they want to receive it, which is in the home.
Okay, all this makes so much sense, and you have laid it out so clearly that I think it's very easy for anybody to understand exactly what you're talking about. And yet, we have this vastly complex system with so many players involved and so many people who are profiting from some of the things that you point out are really flaws in the system. Given the record so far, how likely do you think it is that we can get even close to accomplishing some of the things that you propose?
I'm very optimistic. You know, as I said, I think it's really telling that the system has changed as dramatically as it's changed in the past 3 months. And, you know, no question, let's not forget, this has happened in the context of a pandemic. And so it has happened certainly out of need. But I think the fact that we have seen the system change this much, that there's been a reduction in those elective services, that suddenly, the telehealth or virtual visit world that was seemed so far out in the distance and so hard to achieve, my physician colleagues have embraced and now are championing. I think these are really positive signs. And I'm very optimistic because of that. I would say that, however, if we don't, and by we here, I mean, policymakers and legislators and other leaders in our systems, if they don't take some of these pragmatic steps to protect the progress that we've made in the context of COVID, where the progress has occurred, and protect our system from unwinding back to how it used to be, as an economist, I'm worried that economics would dictate and we'll end up right back to where we were 3 or 4 months ago. And that would be just such an unfortunate occurrence if that happened. And so I would say, I'm very optimistic because of what we've seen. And hopefully we'll see some embracing of these types of changes. And from what I understand, again, from recent developments in Medicare and some other health insurance companies and other folks out there, I do think we're seeing some tidbits of progress that are embracing some of the types of ideas that we're proposing.
And I'll go back to the beginning, just to remind our listeners that what you said at the outset is that the system that we have had up until now is simply not sustainable. It's not going to be possible to continue that way and keep it the way it is and certainly have anything resembling equity in the system. So I really think it's important to emphasize this, because right now it is a system that really seems more to serve some people than others, isn't it?
I think that's right. I mean, just 5 months ago, we were all worried about and lamenting the lack of affordability of American healthcare. And to your point, the racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare in this country. And obviously in the COVID pandemic, the COVID pandemic has taken precedence and is in the front of all of our minds. But I think it is important for us not to forget, where we were 5 months ago. And to the extent that we can make systematic changes and we can try to capture some of the elements of progress so we don't go back to exactly where we were 5 months ago. That's really fundamentally important. So I thank you for bringing those points up.
Well, thank you, Dr. Amol Nawathe at the University of Pennsylvania's Healthcare Transformation Institute. Very interesting name to that place where you work. And I want to thank you very much for being on our program.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Amol Nawathe at the University of Pennsylvania's Healthcare Transformation Institute. Now, earlier, we promised to look at the all-too-justified anxiety we're all feeling after just 2 months of the era of COVID-19, and that is coming up. But first, since we've heard about what the virus is doing to America's health system, we're going to hear what's happening overseas and how it affects us here in this country. Back in a moment with To The Point. Warren Olney back with To The Point. We've heard how the coronavirus pandemic is wreaking havoc with America's health systems, urban as well as rural, although there may be that silver lining. But it's even more devastating in some other parts of the world. James Blake formerly worked with the International Rescue Commission. He's a journalist who also advises other NGOs and a global group of mayors and businesses in fragile countries with fragile health systems. James, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
You've reported that in one entire African country, there is a total of 4 ventilators.
Right. And unfortunately, this isn't just a case of it being one individual sub-Saharan African country, but there are similar figures in a number of countries, which include Burkina Faso, South Sudan, and unfortunately into places in Syria and the Middle East where the numbers are a little bit higher, but not that much higher in terms of ventilators. So it really is a problem in fragile states across the world.
Well, that's a problem in treating the disease. What about the problem of identifying it in the first place?
Right, and that is also a big issue. I think you can look at it in a number of different ways. First of all, whether the people within these fragile states, whether they are citizens or whether they are displaced, having been in conflict, do they know the symptoms to look out for, which would alert them to having the virus in the first place? And then a second problem is, in the event that they are aware that they have indeed caught the virus, is there anyone able to provide the treatment and isolation necessary to be able to help them recover in that instance?
So areas that have fragile health systems to begin with are in trouble. You mentioned areas of conflict. How much does that exaggerate the difficulty, or is it even possible to estimate? It sounds like it inflates it to a degree that's almost impossible to calculate.
Yes, it's very difficult. I mean, if you imagine somewhere like Syria, which has unfortunately been in a civil war now for over 9 years, and unfortunately airstrikes have targeted hospitals and in some instances also displaced and refugee camps, it's almost impossible to provide treatment in these circumstances for people who are at great risk of catching the virus. And this, unfortunately, is similar in so many other countries because of the number of conflicts that are going on around the world and the difficulties we've had in ending these conflicts. So unfortunately, it really is a situation that could spread very quickly and have very serious consequences, not just within these conflict zones, but as people become scared and try and move into different countries. We saw that just a week or so ago in Iran with people fleeing into neighboring Afghanistan. This will then spread COVID-19 into neighboring countries as well, which will then in turn put their health systems under risk.
I remember hearing former President Jimmy Carter say that at any time in the world, there are 30 or 35 conflicts going on. There may even be more than that. Where are some of the places you've already mentioned, Syria, where it's the worst? And are there particularly countries with this kind of problem in Africa?
Yes. So if you're looking in sub-Saharan Africa, then I would identify Burkina Faso, which has had over the past year a really one of the fastest growing humanitarian emergencies driven by terrorism and ethnic conflicts. And one of the problems they had even before this violence took place there is a lack of healthcare. And so now they're in a situation in Burkina Faso where they have a security problem, they have a lack of healthcare, and they even have a lack of water to be able to try and persuade people to wash their hands and things like that. So even kind of basic steps to prevent prevent catching the virus in the first instance are difficult. Other places that I would highlight within sub-Saharan Africa would be South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and also one that I'm very, very concerned about, and this is linked to COVID-19 but has economic impacts, is Zimbabwe, which because of the government shutdown is having a severe impacts on the economy and food insecurity, all of which is related to this concern around COVID-19.
In many of the places that you have mentioned, there are a lot of displaced persons. What about the impact of that?
Yes, very sadly, those, as you alluded to, the number of displaced persons and refugees is at the highest level, according to the UN, since the end of World War II. And so this is a problem that's a significant issue in many different countries. Unfortunately, refugees and those who've been displaced internally are often those who are forgotten in these instances. And unfortunately, again, that they don't necessarily have a voice to raise attention to what's happening. If you look a little bit more closely at some of the issues in a refugee camp, for instance, it's very, very difficult to practice social distancing. You're often in tents or sleeping on mattresses, which are very close together. And therefore, if there's even just one single case within a refugee camp, the potential for it to kind of spread viciously across the refugee camp is, you know, very, very high. And then obviously the lack of ways of kind of treating this after it has occurred means that, that the risk is going to kind of continue to grow higher and higher because of the lack of health equipment and aid and so on and so forth.
I think many people in our audience will be interested in what's happening in Gaza, so densely populated as it is.
Yes, I agree that Gaza is one of the places that I would be very concerned with. As you mentioned, it's very dense. It has security problems with various Islamist and radical Islamist groups, and then obviously a weak government in both the Palestinian side and in Gaza itself. And so one of the things that we are anticipating seeing is that armed groups, in this case Hamas, look to kind of exert their influence over the population by providing aid and food and things like that, where the government isn't able to do and where humanitarian agencies haven't been able to reach. And Gaza, unfortunately, is a very difficult place for humanitarian groups to reach for a number of reasons, which are geopolitical and due to the Israel-Palestine conflict.
Might this lead to a greater strength on the part of ISIS, which in the areas that it occupied before it was driven out, it apparently provided services, picking up the garbage and things of that kind, much better than the governments that it had replaced?
I think that that is something that both aid agencies and also security officials are concerned about. You know, one of the problems that we have, as I mentioned at the start of our conversation, is that there are so many conflict zones going on, and these conflicts are taking place in areas where there are a weak state presence. And so therefore, groups which look to capitalize on the situation where people perhaps can't go to work and can't pay for food or staying at home and things like that, it is the non-state actors, whether it's a terrorist group like the so-called Islamic State, or I was relatively recently in El Salvador, for instance, and I've been receiving reports over the last few days about organized criminal gangs giving out food in the streets of San Salvador as they try and legitimize themselves as the main actor in these locations. So yes, I think to answer your question, these conditions provide a very strong opportunity for groups such as the Islamic State to try and build up their support base and therefore their power in the kind of medium term.
So governments then that are subject to non-state actors because they're weak are one thing. What about regimes that are autocratic? Are they using this as an opportunity to crack down?
Again, sadly, the answer to your question is yes. In some instances, one of the most problematic countries we've seen so far is in Hungary, where the government has used this COVID crisis as a way of ensuring that its autocratic message and methods are pervasive across the country. And another, again, going back to El Salvador, we've seen very strong incidents of state impunity, where the government and security forces have looked to, you know, clamp down very hard, whether it's on people who are in prisons already, or whether it's people who they suspect to have caught COVID-19 in a different country, and the way that they're treating them is raises all kinds of human rights questions. So this is very much an issue that we're worried about as well. Is autocratic governments basically taking advantage of the situation to ensure that their messaging and their influence is the way that their citizens will respond to this crisis?
so many different countries with so many different problems, it's almost hard to generalize or to ask you to generalize. But what about getting information out to people who may not understand that the pandemic, in fact, exists?
Yes. Again, this is a serious issue, which the UN and a number of the aid agencies are trying to deal with at this stage. If we look back towards what happened during the Ebola crisis from a number of years ago, one of the big issues that the aid agencies found was that the communities that they were trying to reach and provide aid services to in the hope of saving lives were actually suspicious of what they were doing there in the first place and were not listening to their advice in terms of how they could best mitigate the risks to themselves. So one of the things which is already proving to be very difficult in some of the humanitarian responses which are taking place across these fragile states is trying to ensure that aid agencies are seen as providing legitimate and important advice, and that health advisors attached to these agencies are, you know, importantly become kind of spokespersons for these particular areas, so that the citizens within these communities can get the real message about what they should be doing to try and avoid catching the virus and how they should respond if they have got it. And unfortunately, we're in this situation across the world where there's always different actors looking to spread different messaging. And this has therefore become very complicated within the context of mis and disinformation. But it's a very, very tricky issue that is going to have to be addressed during the humanitarian response.
I understand the president of Brazil has said that only homosexuals are subject to the coronavirus. Are there other incidents like that? And when that happens with a head of state, how difficult is it to overcome that?
Well, yes, I think certainly there are issues. We had obviously in the U.S. A few weeks ago with President Trump and the bleach remarks. You know, my understanding from reading around that was that there was an increase in people calling these companies around bleach and so on and so forth. So when it's a head of state, whether it's in the U.S., whether it's in Brazil, or whether it's elsewhere, it becomes very difficult for people to know who to trust. But when there's a country which is autocratic and the media is not free, then the difficulty of getting reliable information, which is not there to protect the messages that the government wants to get out, becomes very difficult. And one of the things that I'm personally very concerned about is within certain countries in sub-Saharan Africa, Russian and Chinese companies and officials have been buying news agencies, which they're using to spread their own messaging. And obviously some of the things that we've heard over the last few weeks from different and not reliable sources are that, for instance, the pandemic has been caused by a US biological weapon, and that aid agencies are there to spread this virus into different communities. So trying to combat that type of thing is very, very difficult within these kind of authoritarian governments, countries where the media is obviously not free in many instances.
What about the effectiveness of international humanitarian agencies under these circumstances, and particularly the World Health Organization? Is there really the ability to do very much given the breadth of the problem that you have described and how difficult it is in so many ways, in so many different places?
Look, my view on this situation is that the more money that is given to institutions such as the World Health Organization and to agencies such as the International Rescue Committee, Mercy Corps, MSF, and others, that the more lives that will be saved during what goes on in the coming weeks and months in these fragile states. You know, it's going to be a huge problem. I've never seen in my lifetime, and I think even people who are significantly older than me have never seen an instance where a crisis is taking place in so many different countries at the same time. But it's only through institutions such as the United Nations and obviously working closely with the World Health Organization and in collaboration with the various humanitarian organizations that they can try and target the providing aid in the areas that are most at risk. And that's where the humanitarian response has got to start. It has got to help out in the countries which are most at risk of the most number of deaths, and these are often in the most inaccessible places. The more money that can go to them, these top-branded agencies and humanitarian organizations, the more good that they will do. But, you know, this is a very, very large problem, and unfortunately there are going to be, you know, a huge number of cases, and I suspect, very sadly, a huge number of deaths, no matter, you know, how much and how effective the response is.
We know, of course, that President Trump has suspended American aid to the World Health Organization. He's apparently reflecting on that as we speak. How important is the American contribution to the World Health Organization, and is it able to function without U.S. support?
My understanding is that the United States was, prior to this review process, the largest funder of the World Health Organization. So its significance in providing money cannot be underestimated. A number of countries, including the United Kingdom and its Prime Minister Boris Johnson, have attempted to increase the amount of aid they're providing to the World Health Organization as a way to try and make up for the loss, at least temporarily, from the US and Donald Trump. But, you know, realistically speaking, it's, as I said in my previous answer, for this situation, this crisis, to be dealt with, it's going to need strong global institutions to take the lead, and the World Health Organization and the UN will have to be forefront of that. Already we've seen that the US aid, the amount of money they've cut to the World Health Organization has had an impact in places like Yemen, which again is undergoing a conflict and a humanitarian crisis there. And ideally, we need more countries like Britain to provide cash to support what the WHO can do and to lead as much as possible. And my personal advice to the US government would be that this crisis will only be addressed when the weakest country in the world and the most voiceless of people in the world are also hopefully provided with vaccines. And until that takes place, because of the movement of people, because of the movement in goods and so on and so forth, the virus will continue to spread into different countries. So it needs a global response and can't be dealt with on a nationalistic basis.
That's, of course, a wonderful goal to hope for. In the meantime, Doctors Without Borders, the International Rescue Commission that you used to belong to, and others are having, I would assume, the same kind of problems that we're having in the developed world, which is that we don't know very much about this virus or very well how to treat it, much less do we have a vaccine.
Right. And that certainly is a problem, and the best strategies at the moment are the prevention step, where people are given the best advice possible in terms of mitigating your risk of catching the virus, and that is washing your hands, keeping social distance, and those basic steps. And obviously one of the things that humanitarian organizations can do is in countries where there is a lack of water, a lack of soap and things like that, they can provide these kind of essential services. And then they can provide the advice in terms of ensuring that best practices like this are adhered to. Beyond that, there needs to be a significant boost, and this is more on the development angle than the humanitarian side. But increasing, like we discussed in the first part to your questions, ventilators in these countries, so that if people and when people do get sick, that they have the opportunity to be treated as effectively as possible. And like we've seen, you know, in very developed healthcare systems, like in the UK and in the US and elsewhere, that doesn't mean necessarily that everyone will survive, but it will increase the number of people who survive if they have the necessary equipment. And, you know, you can go on with a further list that probably includes, you know, oxygen supplies and PPE kits and all of these things and the right medical staff. But it is very much a containment exercise at this point, while, you know, hopefully the search and the race to find a vaccine also takes place simultaneous to that.
In the meantime, with containment so difficult, does this mean that those of us in the developed world, presumably we are better able to get a handle on it, will still be in great danger because of what's going on in other parts of the world?
I think that that's that is the case. One of the things that I've been working on over the last few weeks is looking at the situation on the U.S.-Mexico border, and also into Central America. And, you know, one of the difficult situations we have is that people who are seeking asylum or have attempted to seek asylum in the US, you know, they will seek, if they don't get entry and they have COVID-19 potentially, and something that happens quite frequently is that people are desperate and they will try and seek ways which are not legal to get across the border. So, you know, through smuggling or through, in some instances, you know, even crossing in dinghies across parts into Texas and things like that. People who are carrying COVID-19 will likely come into the U.S. The reality of the situation is you can build walls and make borders hard to cross, but there are always ways that people will find to cross those walls, whether it's under them by digging under them, or whether it's by hiring what we call coyotes to get across to the US. It will continue to happen, and because COVID-19 is not necessarily being addressed at the same pace in Mexico, Central America, as it is in the US at the moment, that means we're, you know, at risk from new outbreaks down the line.
So, as we hear so often, the world is globalized in many, many ways, and I take it this is one of them, and it makes good sense for us to be very concerned about what's happening in other parts of the world. I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for covering such an important issue. I appreciate your time.
James Blake, again, is with the International Rescue Commission. He is an advisor to various NGOs, including mayors and businesses in fragile countries. I'd like to know more about what they are up to, and perhaps when we have another time to talk, we'll be able to do it. Thanks again.
Thank you very much.
So we've heard some bad news on this podcast, and at least the possibility of good news. With that unanticipated silver lining, the prospect that our medical system just might change for the better. But that's hardly enough to relieve the anxiety that we are all feeling. After all, this is a global emergency like nothing any of us has ever faced before. Deborah Netburn has written about that for the LA Times. And Deborah, thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Now, we're just 2 months into this global emergency, but we're already hearing about the kind of symptoms that it's causing in terms of people's mental distress. What are they?
So scientists say that the effects of this quarantine could be depression, anxiety, possibly some post-traumatic stress. Those are maybe insomnia, irritability.
So those are the kinds of things then that are anticipated. And I would say to our audience, you know, don't worry if you've had those things. It's perfectly normal.
Right. That's correct. I think it's actually helpful to know it's normal. And it's also helpful to know that a lot of health experts say that they'll be alleviated when this is over for many people, not everybody. But, you know, that's good to know.
Well, what's the worst of it, and what can people do about it, according to the few people that you've talked to?
So I talked to this really interesting researcher named Steve Cole at UCLA, and he studies the physical impacts of loneliness. So it's not just that you emotionally feel bad when you're lonely, but it can affect like your physical body. It can make you have a inflammation response, which can be really bad for a whole host of health reasons. And I think a lot of us are feeling lonely, but it's also really good to know that he says you can interrupt that loneliness by just reaching out to friends. And so throughout my reporting on mental health during this quarantine, just the refrain over and over again is how important it is to reach out to people in your life. You know, just talking to a friend can make you feel so much less alone, talking to a family member. So even if you can't see them personally, just communicating can make a big difference.
You said there also is the possibility of post-traumatic stress syndrome or disorder, as they call it. Who is more likely to have that and who is less likely?
I think it really comes down a lot to who has resources, who is able to stay home right now. If you have a bigger home and your family can disperse if they need to, you know, just to take a break from each other, that probably makes things easier for you. Being crowded in a small house without any breaks or any escapes could be a lot more difficult. There's also evidence that domestic abuse goes up in times like this. So certainly for people living in those situations, there probably will be some post-traumatic stress, even when this is over.
And as to the loneliness factor, you talked to somebody who's a former astronaut.
Yeah, he was great. The thing that he said that struck me was that in his own research on spending time with just a small group of people, like an extended amount of time with a small group of people, he found evidence of irritation, irritability, depression too, and stress. And he said that a lot of what comes up in a time like this is actually the same feelings you have even when things are normal, but usually you just have access to a whole bunch of tools you probably don't even think about to just make you feel better. You know, like some people just want to go out for a drink with friends, but that's not a possibility now. Doing like a yoga class at your favorite yoga studio, not a possibility right now. So he said that, that's a lot of us just need to kind of rethink how we deal with these mental, these issues that come up since we don't have access to our usual tools.
Given that nobody knows what's going to happen, is this harder on people who are elderly and who've had a lot of experience or on kids who haven't had any experience at all?
You know, that's a really interesting question. And I feel like I've seen different responses that elderly people are having because many elderly people are isolated, and that's under normal circumstances and even more so now. So that's not good. But then I've also read some stories about people being used to being alone, and that was something that was also really interesting to me in my reporting, is that loneliness doesn't mean being alone. Loneliness is a feeling, when you can be lonely at a big party. It's that feeling of wanting to be with people and not being able to be with people. But if you are used to being alone and you don't mind being alone, then this might be fine for you. This might not be that challenging.
And is for children, is it just fear of the unknown and what their futures might be like?
Well, that's also a good question. I have two kids myself. They don't seem that freaked out, to be honest.
Good.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes they get upset, but they seem to have adapted, lucky for me, I guess, but pretty well. And one of the things the researchers I've talked to about this have said is that kids are going to take their cues from their parents. And so, you know, if the parents are really working to try to manage their feelings and emotions and regulate those, the kids will learn from that. If the parents are just freaking out, high anxiety, high stress, the kids will learn that. I'm pretty emotional, so my kids have definitely seen me get upset. But, you know, I explained to them, I think it's okay to be upset sometimes. You know, this is upsetting. And, you know, and then I'm trying to use my tools. Like, these researchers really helped me to manage my own emotions around this time.
Back to the astronaut and to the fact that this is something that is different from anything that's happened to anybody who was alive at this time. I thought one of the great lines that you got was from somebody who said, the program in our that our body was set up for is for a world that no longer exists.
Yeah, I really, I like that too. Well, but what he was talking about, that was the UCLA researcher, and he was talking about that immune response, and that our bodies have been wired to see being alone as dangerous, actually, because, you know, thousands of years ago, if you were by yourself, you were more vulnerable to an attack from a saber-toothed tiger. You know, if you got injured and you were alone, you were less likely to survive that injury. You know, at this point, our body doesn't need to make this giant inflammatory antibacterial response just because we're alone, but it still does.
Okay, it does, and it will. And we're just going to have to cope with it at least for a while. Deborah Netburn with the LA Times, great to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
The producer of To the Point is Andrea Brody. Our engineer is Chuck Prevetary. And other episodes are available on your favorite podcasting app. We are at To the Point_KCRW. You can tweet me at WarrenAlney1. As I've said before, we're not going to let social distancing prevent us from podcasting. We're all doing this from home. I hope you're well and happy at home as well. And if you have to go out, and you are going out, do so very, very carefully. Thanks so much for being with us. Join us again.